The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha. Today we're going to talk about parables. There are a lot of parables in the Lotus Sutra. And the ones we're going to talk about today are intended to help us to understand the teaching of the Buddha's skillful means to help people. The Buddha's been telling his disciples that they can become Buddhas. Up to now, they've been content with the lesser nirvana, the cessation of what they call the outflows of greed, anger, and delusion, and finding peace of heart, a cessation of suffering. And they'd thought they were enlightened, but the Buddha says, no, not yet. In the Pali Canon, there's a story of the Buddha walking in the forest with some of his monks. And it tells them that the teachings he has given them are like a handful of leaves. And there is a whole forest of leaves that he has not given them. There's a whole lot of wisdom that he has not taught them. And here in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha is saying that his disciples have a lot further to go. They've been content with the lesser vehicles we just talked about yesterday, and now he's going to preach the great vehicle. The great vehicle, the Mahayana, the practice of bodhisattvas who vow to help all beings. And the last part of the Lotus Sutra tells us how to do that. But here, the Buddha's introducing it, it's telling his disciples that they can go on beyond the lesser teachings and that they too can become Buddhas. The Bodhisattva way, the way to Buddhahood. And the Buddha himself spent many lives as a Bodhisattva, giving himself endlessly to help beings, sometimes in dramatic ways. The disciples here say that they thought they were incapable of becoming Buddhas, that it was for other people. So they just contented themselves with simply finding nirvana. And they tell the parable of the lost son. Again, it's the one that is well known, and I will relate it. And it's not completely believable, as usual, but it has really good points to illustrate. Well, there's a father and one son, his only child. And then the son's a young man. He runs off. I don't quite know why, but he runs away and gets lost. He doesn't know how to make a living. He's scrounging a simple, meager existence from day to day, wandering around, sort of ragged and confused. For a long time, the parable says 50 years, but in fact, clearly he's still a fairly young person when he finally finds his way back. His father's moved in the meantime, and he's come to another city, and he's amassed a huge amount of wealth. He's done really well for himself. But he still feels really sad that he's lost his son. He never forgets him, and he grieves that he's not with him. And one reason he's sad is because he's got no one to pass all this wealth on to. He doesn't know what to do with it all. Where's his son? He has no inheritor. And the son eventually somehow finds his way to his father's place and doesn't recognize him. He sees this immensely wealthy, powerful person and thinks it must be some kind of a king or something. The father instantly recognizes the son. He knows it's him. But the son's frightened. And when the father sends someone to go and, you know, catch him and bring him to him, the son runs away, he's terrified, runs away in fear. And when they lay hold of him, he says, I haven't done anything wrong. They're going to kill him and really harm him. But then they let him go back to the father. And the father says, don't worry, we'll try another way. And then he sends two of his attendants who has them disguise themselves as really lowly workmen. The son, meanwhile, has gone off to a village looking for work. And these two lowly-seeming workmen, i.e. the father's attendants, approach him sort of casually and say, oh, by the way, there's a work over there. If you want, you can get double the extra double the wages, the normal wage. And you can come and work with us if you like. He needs a worker. So the son's really happy. He comes back to the father's place and is given work moving excrement, piles of excrement, probably from horses or something. And he's happy because he gets his wages, a day's wages. It's really quite something for him, especially the double the normal wage. So he's quite happy doing this. And various people work with him. His father sees him now and then. Every now and then he comes out, and sometimes he's encouraging, sometimes he scolds him, saying he had to work harder. He just pretends to treat him like a normal workman. 20 years go by. Well, of course, the son would be 70-year-old. No, actually, more than that. The father would be 130 or something. But we don't worry about this. So a long time goes by, and the son is still patiently, slowly moving piles of excrement. And then gradually, the father starts to encourage him. He says, you know, I've been watching you. You're not, you know, crabby and bad-tempered and lazy or deceitful like some of the other workers I've had. You're clearly honest and reliable, and I'm going to give you some more responsibility. So he starts having him take care of some of the goods, you know, dispersing things and dealing with things. But they're not his own. He doesn't have any wish for these things. They belong to the father. He has no thought that he might ever inherit any of this. He's just a lowly worker. And then eventually the father's getting old and sick, and he knows he's going to die soon. And he sees that the son is ready. So he calls everyone together and says, this person is my son, long lost. He doesn't know it, but is indeed is my son, and he will inherit all my wealth. And the son is overjoyed. He never expected this. Well, the disciples say, you know, they're like this lost son who ran away and became a beggar. They wandered away and got lost and confused. And they didn't know their true inheritance. When they see the Buddha, they don't recognize him. The Buddha, of course, is the father. And, you know, in the story, the father's great worry is that he's got no one to leave his great wealth to, i.e. the Buddha, really his great wish is that he can pass on his Dharma to other beings. Otherwise, you know, it's no use. He wants to pass it on to the world. And that's the thing he's really concerned about. He doesn't want it just to die out. And the Buddha recognizes his disciples as his true inheritors. But he can't just tell them that. He has to train them gradually. He doesn't want to frighten them away. So he uses his skillful means to lead them gradually. He promises them the reward of nirvana, the lesser nirvana, you know, a freedom from suffering, like the father giving his son this lowly work of moving excrement, and daily wages are like the peace that you get from a little bit of understanding. And the son has been contented with this and has no desire for anything better. The disciples thought that was it. You know, we've reached the end, this is it. They don't know this more. They thought the Buddhahood wasn't for them. So they've been content with this lesser goal of nirvana, feeling that that was enough, and it was all they deserved, actually. And then gradually, as I said, the father gives his son more responsibility. The Buddha gives people better, you know, more, not better, deeper teaching. And finally, he sees that the disciples have trained themselves enough to be taught the Buddha wisdom, the great vehicle, the Lotus Sutra. And then they can know that they too can become Buddha. They can inherit the wealth of the Dharma and learn the way of the Bodhisattva. Well, this isn't the Buddha's parable. It's told by the disciples of themselves. And they are like us. We judge ourselves as unworthy, unable to become Buddhas. So we have to learn gradually through training ourselves. We can't just rush in right away. And this is not inferior training. It's the foundation of our practice, that simple daily training of our greed, anger, and delusion. We have to learn to deal with that, our ignorance and fear and hatred. We have to train our selfishness. We all have to do that. It's not an inferior thing at all. It's the foundation. The father can't give his son anything until his son has done a whole lot of work, you know. The idea that we're inferior and we're unworthy is actually just selfishness. As one of our dear old monks has said many, you know, and I've quoted many times, inadequacy is a very mountain of selfishness. It doesn't seem like it, but actually saying, oh, I can't do it, oh, I'm not good enough, oh, you know, it's all about me and my lack. And conversely, overconfidence and thinking we know everything is also a mountain of selfishness. We all have a mountain of selfishness, and we need to train it. We all have our mountain of excrement, as it were, and we need to learn where to apply our shovel. And it's good training. It's not inferior. We have to train that feeling of me and my stuff, you know, our selfishness, our self-partiality, our self-concern, to see that it's not about me. Really, the Dharma is not about myself. We start off that way. You have to deal with that whole mountain and gradually to see it's not just about myself. And the son gradually starts taking on, dealing with some of the father's goods. They're not his. He's done a lot of his work, and now he can be entrusted with more because he's done a lot of his work on himself. But he's had to work for a very long time before he's ready to receive his inheritance. But it's essential. As I said, we can't just rush in to our training and expect immediate results to be handed the Buddha wisdom. We have to work hard for it. The son doesn't recognize his father. He's got no clue that he's his son. He feels lowly. And he has to learn true humility, which is beyond both adequacy and inadequacy, beyond thinking we know everything and thinking we're lowly and we know nothing. We have to work hard without expectation of some reward. The lost son has no idea that he'll inherit anything. He has no expectation. He just works hard and patiently, day after day, receiving his daily wages. The daily benefits of training, meditation and keeping to the precepts, the growing peace of heart. And gradually he grows in confidence, i.e. faith. We have to cultivate our faith and confidence in our own practice that we can do it. Don't think you don't have faith. We all have faith or you wouldn't be here at all. As Reverend Master used to say, you have faith that the sun will rise tomorrow, don't you? You've got faith. Just have faith in faith and not worry. And as we go on in training, we start to see its benefits and our faith deepens. We have more confidence. Our selfishness lessens. Our desire to get something for ourselves out of training diminishes. And we do it because it's good to do, not to get something. And this helps immeasurably with our suffering, training for its own sake, not trying to get something. The daily, patient removing of the defilements of greed, anger, and delusion. This nirvana, for most of us, it's the increasing peace of heart, and it's not to be disparaged. It is part of the way, and we build on that. And this is what the Buddha is trying to teach in this parable. You start with doing that simple, lowly work, and then gradually you can come to something deeper. Now the Buddha relates a parable, the parable of the herbs, which is related to what's gone before. Some of us know this parable because we've sung the verse part, and it's really beautiful. The Buddha, actually it's more like a simile, the Buddha is likened to a great cloud that covers the whole earth and pours rain, unstintingly, huge amounts of rain. The rain of the Dharma on all the plants, large and small, without stint and without preference. He pours the rain on all equally. All the plants get rain. The smaller plants can only absorb a little bit of rain. And the young trees can absorb more, and the big trees can absorb a lot of rain. All the plants are different, and they all grow in different ways, like us. But the rain falls on everything without making distinctions. It doesn't avoid some and pour more rain on others. It's the same rain for everybody. Same Dharma for everyone. No preference, no difference for everybody. However, because we're all different and we have different capacities, we absorb the Dharma in different ways. And this is the teaching of skillful means. The Buddha teaches different people in different ways. We've got the ordinary trainees, like us, the small plants. And there's those who've gone further in training, bigger plants. The young trees, people starting on the bodhisattva path. Or maybe that's us, I don't know. And there's big trees, people who've gone far in their bodhisattva practice. All different. And, as the Buddha points out, the plants don't know or care if they're big plants or little plants. They just grow. We don't have to worry, am I a big plant or a little plant? Am I a bodhisattva? Am I just a lowly trainee? Am I a good person? Am I doing better than somebody else? It's completely useless, unnecessary, because the same Dharma pours on all of us. The same Dharma, the same flavor, the flavor of liberation. It's not something different for different beings. We all have the teaching. It's right there for us. It's not we don't have something like one old master said, there is no, I think a Buddha said, there is no closed fist that's keeping things secret and won't let you know how to train. It's the same Dharma for everybody. So we have the smaller vehicles and the great vehicle. The same teaching, but done in different skillful ways. The same Dharma, the same basic training. The Buddha pours it for everybody. No distinction and no preference. He makes this very clear. And he says, we don't even know the extent of the blessings of the Dharma. We don't know how fortunate we are. Then we have another parable, the parable of the phantom city. There's a band of people looking for treasure, and they have a leader. And they're going through some really difficult terrain, a really steep, dark, dangerous road. No buildings, no houses, it's isolated. It's a long way, and it's really hard, up and down, along through the mountains. And they get tired. And finally, they get disheartened, and they say to the leader, we don't want to go anymore. We want to go home. We've had it. We're exhausted. We're going to turn around and go back. And the leader thinks, how unfortunate, because they're turning their backs on this opportunity. They're going to look for this treasure, and they're giving up. What am I going to do? So he conjures up a phantom city just a few miles away. And he says, don't worry, look, there's a city right there. You can go and rest, get refreshed, have something to eat, you know, take as much rest as you need, and then see if you can carry on. The people are really happy, and they go to the city, they rest, and it works. They go, they rest, they take their ease, and rest, and feel much better. And then the city disappears. The leader gathers them all together and says, I just conjured up the city for you to help you rest, and now you can continue. The goal is not far off. The treasure is not far away. Just keep going and you'll get there. And the people are encouraged and they continue. Well, the phantom city is this lesser goal of nirvana we've been talking about. To encourage people to keep going. The phantom city really is refreshing. It does help. The people find rest and ease. When we've trained for a while, our suffering diminishes. And we find some peace of heart, and we're encouraged to keep going. The Lotus Sutra is always emphasizing how long it takes to become a Buddha, you know, millions of kalpas and eons, and it can sound quite discouraging. We talked about this the other day. It may not be quite as far as we think, but it can seem like an awful long way. And this lesser goal of some peace of heart and just a little bit of relief from suffering can seem more reachable. And then the goal of Buddhahood is actually not all that much further on. We don't know. Again, these are skillful means to help people, to help us to keep going. This phantom city. The teachings often warn us about stopping training when we found some peace. You don't want to get stuck in the phantom city. It's a phantom in a sense. Stopping training, thinking we're enlightened. Or being satisfied with just having a bit more peace, a little more peaceful mind, being able to be a little bit happier, you know. Oh, fine, I've done it. This is good enough. That's all I need. And I thought of Reverend Master Jiyu and the Lake of Quietism and the Lotus Blossom, those who read it, How to Grow a Lotus Blossom. There's a place where she's gone through all kinds of dangers and difficulties. And she comes to a lake, beautiful, quiet, peaceful lake, with the moon hanging above it. And she says, oh, what a lovely, peaceful place. I think I'll sit down here, take a rest. Then after a little while, she sees that it's an illusion. The moon is just hanging on a piece of string from somewhere. The lake is not a real lake. And a voice says, here you do not stay. And the lake moves aside, and she goes on. And I think that chapter is entitled, Heaven is the Most Dangerous of All Places, because you can get stuck there and not want to continue. So we have to be willing to leave the phantom city to see that actually it's not the end of things. It's not what we're aiming at. It's just a nice, it's an encouraging thing. Okay, we're on our way, we're doing okay, but we keep going. We always continue, always going on, always becoming Buddha, as we've said. All these parables are about skillful means. The rich father slowly helping his humble son gain confidence so that he can come into his true inheritance and be able to accept it. The rain of the Dharma pouring on all beings, the same Dharma for everybody. But people absorb it in their different ways, and the Buddha teaches in different ways. The phantom city where people can rest and then continue on their way, refreshed and encouraged, and not just give up. These are all skillful means. A word about goals. We don't tend to talk a lot about the goal of enlightenment. We talk about training, doing our best here and now. If we focus on a goal, trying to get something, we can just obstruct our own way, a self wanting something, which isn't the point at all. Training and enlightenment are one thing, as great Master Dogen says. We put our enlightenment into practice by doing our training. We're not looking for something else. We're not trying to get something that we don't have. Number of the parables are about having the jewel within ourselves. And there's another one we'll talk about another time. Finding the jewel, the truth, within ourselves. Not to be looking for something else. Not to be trying to get something for me. Because that defeats our purpose. It's just another aspect of being a self. This is why, with the plants, the simile of the plants don't know if they're big or little plants. And they don't have to worry. Little plants can grow into big plants. Some small plants remain small plants, but they can give great benefit. Some of them are medicinal plants. They help people. Some of them become great trees. Does it mean they're better? No, it means they're bigger. You know, not for us to compare ourselves with others or to worry that we just seem to be a little plant. Not to think we don't deserve the inheritance. It's all about we can do it. We have Buddha nature, we can find the truth, but still we're not trying to reach a goal. The goal of goalness, as they talk about sometimes. We're not trying to get something. It's not like that. It's more like we're trying to relinquish something and realize something that we have already. We're not getting something from somewhere else. And it's not about us. So it's better just to give ourselves wholeheartedly to the practice and not be trying to get something. It's not a bargain. We're not giving with one hand and taking with the other. We have to give with both hands, completely, wholeheartedly. And this is why reverence and devotion are so essential. Bowing, reverence for something greater than ourselves, giving ourselves completely to that which is greater than we are, in faith. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.